Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Workforce, Labor, Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. I want to recognize today that a quorum is present. Vice Chair Mecklen, have you had a chance to go through yesterday's minutes of March 12th?
Mr. Chair, I have gone through the March 12th minutes, and I've moved them.
Thank you very much, Representative Mecklen. Any comments to the minutes, members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are carried from yesterday. Today, members, we have one House file on the docket today, House File 1976. Obviously, we've got a very full room today. We've got people outside in the overflow room as well, kind of watching from us there. We've got people on Zoom today that we're going to be hearing from. And today is about, again, I'll be giving a brief overview of the bill of 1976, but today is about hearing from our testifiers. To all testifiers that are here today, I want to make sure that I'm clear about this, and the Chair Mecklen will step in after I step away from the chair seat, is that we need to really be tight on our minutes today. So 2 minutes is what we have today. We're going to be cutting you off at about 2 minutes, 2:10. Look at your presentations. I know that's a lot to ask, and I apologize, but we have a lot of people. We are not planning to go into testifying tonight, and we have to be out of the room by 10 o'clock. So we're going to be trying to be very efficient with your time, with our time, and our plan is, after consulting with Co-Chair Pinto, is we'll come back to this next Wednesday if there's follow-up, because we're going to have plenty of time for members to ask questions if the testimony goes a little bit longer. So this bill is being laid over. It's not moving out of this committee. We want to make sure that we have plenty of time to talk about this. So I think with that, again, just the two-minute warning. Our assistant Ann will be showing up the cards, so this just know that is what will be coming. We're trying to be as respectful as we can, and the chair will jump in if we need to. So I appreciate your understanding of that. And at this time, audience and members, I'll take the testifying stand. Thank you.
Representative Baker, I'm going to move House File 1976 to be laid over for further consideration. If you'd like to present your opening statements.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also, maybe at this time, could just add my author's amendment if I could, and then just to get the bill in the shape that I like it, and then we can kind of talk about it broadly, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Your A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, again, we've had some just some updates to this. I'd like to be able to include the A1 amendment to the bill as presented and ask for your support. Thank you.
Any questions or discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I'm proud to present House File 1976 as amended for possible consideration at a future time. What we are doing today is bringing some ideas, some thoughts that I've been working on for the last couple of years. And I think that what we will hear today are testifiers in support and opposing the bill. We had some of those the last couple of years, but today is a time, and I want to make sure that as the trifecta was broken at the last election, this is a chance for others that did not feel heard to be heard today. And again, I've created this bill over hundreds and hundreds of discussions I've had with unions, with business leaders, with small business owners, with counties, with school districts. This is not something that just was a reaction. It was something that I was really worried about, feeling like this was not ready in the way it was written as a one-size-fits-all. And again, I just want to make sure that this has been a lot of work to bring this together today, and I hope that you will find that this is well thought of. And it is not a perfect bill, members. This is not right. It's not all the way right. And I will tell you, House File 2 from last session is not right either. But I'm hoping that what this does is it brings together some collaboration, some ideas that we can seriously sit down and start working on what we can get behind, because 50% of the program is also the partners with businesses. They are 50% of the program, and their voices have not been heard. And we need to make sure we have those options as we move forward. So members, I want to make sure that what I want to do is brief overview, and then we'll get right to testimony. What this bill does do is just, it gives us more choices. It gives unions choices, collective bargaining agreements that are very complex. They've been layered and built over years with good planning to integrate benefits, wages, sick pay, pensions, etc. They have worked on those agreements for many, many years, and this has to have a discussion. What this bill does, it provides the ability to have a discussion at the next collective bargaining agreement to make sure that those union members and the administration have a conversation about how do we integrate this. It also offers choice to smaller companies, a lighter version, if you will, that is keeping the workforce remaining in their businesses, not gone 12 weeks or 20 weeks like it's currently written. It downsizes a bit because the biggest challenge for small businesses is to have somebody out of that little business for such a long period of time. There is much less of a chance to hire a replacement or a person for a short time in a small business than it is a larger business. They don't have the capacity. This is what this tries to recognize. This offers a more fair salary benefit. What I'm proposing today is a two-thirds pay for everyone, not a 50% up to 90% scale. If you pay the tax on your based on your wages, you should be able to at least get something that you kind of can figure out what is your pay. And two-thirds of your wage, I think, is a good, fair way to do this. Unemployment insurance is around 50%. This is a two-thirds pay. I think that was something that I heard loud and clear. Also, what this does is it allows Deed the opportunity and a choice. If they want to put out for bid a private contractor to run the call center, for example, to run parts of the program, they can do that. They're still administrating the overall program of this. I'm not trying to, you know, have the state not be involved. They are. Clearly they are. But also they have the ability to, by their choice, to offer a contract to someone else if they think they can do it better. But what I did also hear when I was building this bill, members, the last 2 years is it was important to the DFL to not let anybody be left out. This is not a repeal. This is actually right-sizing it, but everybody is included. Nobody is left out. That isn't already left out from the very slices of small things that you had before. It expands the seasonal exceptions a little bit from 150 days to 180 days. But it really does try to right-size this bill. So members, happy to talk later on questions. We're to get to testifiers now, Mr. Chair. But we're trying to make sure that we have a good option of things and options we can talk about for this bill as we move forward. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to hearing from a lot of people today.
Thank you, Chair Baker. So our first testifier will be Andy Wilkie, and then the second will be Tammy Philippi. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andy Wilkie. I serve as Executive Vice President at Greater Mankato Growth. We're the Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development organization serving the Greater Mankato area, including 900 members. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today, especially in front of our Greater Mankato Leadership Institute, which is also in the room as well. Greater Mankato attracts a workforce of an area that includes 22 counties in southern Minnesota and northern Iowa. We are home to more than 25,000 college students and have the highest rate of retail spending per capita, more than all other Minnesota metros. And agriculture is at the core of our economy. We are the green seam. More soybeans are processed in Mankato than any other city in North America. To the proposal before us, all of our members sympathize with the many goals of the paid family leave legislation passed in 2023. However, there continues to be considerable uncertainty employers in Greater Mankato and throughout the state. As passed, the program will be the most generous and expansive in the nation. Further, the law does not align well with well-established programs such as Family Medical Leave Act and unemployment insurance. Also, the law does not adequately consider the generous benefits that some employees, particularly public employees, have and may have already be receiving. The law, as written, also includes an expansive definition of family member, and it's difficult to understand who may not be considered a family member. Perhaps most importantly, the impact on small businesses continues to be a major concern that has not been adequately accounted for. The small businesses who employ nearly half of the Minnesota workforce are most at risk with the new program. While many small business owners are sympathetic, the goals of the program may be economically unviable. I want to thank Chair Baker for his proposals in this bill today. The adjustments to the benefit amount, covered employees, definition of family member, and maximum benefit length will be very much welcomed. Recently, a healthcare provider in Mankato shared that she is going to have trouble absorbing some of the costs in this program, and she has few options to recourse. And our members throughout understand that their employees are the most valuable. Adding burdens and barriers will have negative unintended consequences. I urge you to support House File 1976.
Thank you, Andy. Next will be Tammy Philippi, and Chris Rubish will be next. If you'll introduce yourself and please proceed.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on the Paid Family Medical Leave Program. I appreciate the committee's willingness to consider changes. Honestly, as it stands today, the current law is really an impossible burden for businesses like mine. My name is Tammy Philippi, and I own a business called Frame Minnesota. We are a busy custom picture framing shop in Eagan. In addition to myself, we employ two full-time and one part-time staff. We operate with really lean, small teams. Even short absences have a really significant operational impact. We manufacture each frame on-site one at a time. It's labor intensive. We're part artist, part carpenter, and part customer service. I can't just pull somebody off the street to do this job. We require specialized skills. Usually we never find somebody with experience. It takes a good 6 weeks, 8 weeks to gain basic skills and 4 to 6 months to be competent. For me to replace an employee for 12 or 20 weeks, it's just difficult and probably impossible. And I just plain don't have the budget to keep an extra person on staff when the old one returns. Nor can I afford the increased unemployment premiums that come with laying off that fill-in person. When I had to lay off a staffer during the mortgage crisis, my premiums went up fivefold for 5 years. That was really difficult. That's why I want to highlight the provision in this bill that adjusts the small business leave program to 6 weeks. It's a good step in the right direction. This would make the program so much more workable for businesses like mine. I urge the committee to continue refining the program to ensure small businesses like mine are not disproportionately burdened. Small businesses provide needed services and products, just as I have for nearly 30 years. We want to support our employees, and we want to maintain strong, sustainable businesses. I appreciate your willingness to address our concerns and to ensure both it works for both employees and employers. Thank you.
Thank you, Tammy. Next will be Chris Rubish, and after that will be Brad Leto. If you'd introduce yourself and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Chris Rubish. I'm a cardiac nurse in Duluth, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. Former First Lady Rosalind Carter once said there are only four types of people in the world: those who have been caregivers, those who are caregivers, those who will be caregivers, and those who will need caregivers. And that quote perfectly captures what the Minnesota Paid Family Medical Leave Program is all about: recognizing the realities of life and supporting those who care for our state's most vulnerable and most invisible residents. This program is nothing short of a second Minnesota miracle that boldly shows that the people of our state recognize the vital importance of family, of community, and of being there for each other. But House File 1976, as amended, takes a step back from that promise, excluding categories of workers, cutting down on the length of leave allowed, and creating another opportunity for insurance companies to profit off of the people of Minnesota. I want to especially highlight that many union workers, including M&A members, do not have leave programs like some have described. M&A, along with many other unions and community partners, have proudly chosen to fight for this program to be added not to our contracts, where we alone would see its benefit, but to state law, where the patients we serve and the families we come from would share it with us. The Minnesota Paid Family Leave Bill, as passed last year, is not just a labor bill. It's not an economic policy bill or a tax bill. It's a family values bill. It's a Minnesota values bill. And now it's a Minnesota values law. I urge you No, I beg you, as the father of a three-year-old and the child of a parent with Parkinson's, please vote no on HF 1976 as amended. Thank you.
Thank you. Next will be Brad Lita. On deck will be Ethan Vogel. Introduce yourself and please proceed.
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Brad Leto, and I'm Secretary-Treasurer of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, a federation of unions who represent more than 300,000 working people in nearly every job sector in the corner of our state. And just as an aside, yesterday I've been with the Minnesota AFL-CIO for 25 years. This is the 13th year that I've talked about paid family and medical leave. On behalf of these union members and countless other workers, I am urging this committee to reject by House File 1976. In examining this bill, we can't come to any conclusion other than it is designed to set up the state's paid leave program to fail. First and most importantly, I want to be clear about the Minnesota union movement opposes a provision that intentionally excludes workers covered by collective bargaining. And I know others will talk about that, so I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. In addition, the provision added to by the A1 author's amendment dictating what should be included in the union contract is probably preempted by federal law. Along with excluding union members, this bill also excludes even more seasonal workers, meaning that someone who works even half the year would be eligible to care for themselves or a family member. And regarding House Bill 1976, strikes the provision that allows people to care for a chosen family. While I can't speak for the bill's author, own experience, countless Minnesotans do not have any living relatives or friends and loved ones who are closer than anyone who fits that narrow description in the amendment. The bill also greatly reduces the number of weeks available taken under leave. This legislation hurts lower-income workers by replacing the progressive wage replacement structure in the current law with an across-the-board flat rate, making it nearly impossible for lower-income workers to take leave. And finally, we're extremely concerned with language allowing the state to hand over this program for for-profit corporations. Minnesota state employers are tasked with following the law and making sure those who are eligible for government services receive those services. They are accountable to the people of Minnesota through you, our elected officials. And the Minnesota AFL has great faith in these union workers. By turning into this program an unaccountable corporation, hard-earned tax dollars will open the door to both fraud. There is much, much more wrong with this legislation, but it would exceed the allotted time for testimony. In short, this is a bad bill that puts our groundbreaking paid leave law in jeopardy. We urge the committee to reject House Bill 1976. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leto. Next up is Ethan Vogel. On deck will be Mark Wilson. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. My name is Ethan Vogel, Legislative Director with AFSCME Council 5. AFSCME Council 5 is a public and private sector labor union. We represent roughly 43,000 workers across the entire state. Our members are dispersed throughout hundreds of bargaining units, local unions, and they all have different contracts in place, collective bargaining agreements. We are opposed to House File 1976. We simply cannot rely on the benevolence of employers to provide our members with adequate leave, as this bill suggests we do. While some employers are certainly better than others when it comes to empathizing with employees who need to take time off to spend time with a dying family member or recover from surgery, or bond with a newborn, the lack of empathy and the lack of benevolence is the precise thing that brought us to the coalition supporting paid leave in the first place, more than a decade ago. Some CBAs do have more generous leave policies than others, but it is important to remember that in every case, those policies were negotiated, that employees deferred some other form of compensation to get them. And the paid leave law, as it's currently written, allows exclusive representatives and employers to renegotiate the accrual and paid leave policies to permit an equivalent employer-based paid leave plan, if that is the collective desire, or to otherwise reallocate that deferred compensation. And that's something I anticipate we'll start to see as this law rolls out. But it does so in a way that guarantees workers will have a strong voice in the decision-making process. The changes in this bill simply return workers to a position of relying on the paternalistic benevolence of employers, and we know from experience that this is a model that leaves far too many people behind. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vogel. Mark Wilson will be next, and on deck will be Amy Jo Marks. Introduce yourself and proceed.
I'm Mark Wilson from Owatonna. I do love living in Minnesota, but in the future, I'm not sure I can afford it. My wife and I run a coffee shop, bagel shop, and ice cream shop. We're from scratch bakery 6 days a week. We employ 20 people. Of those 20 people, a fourth are full-time. A fourth are full-time adults that choose to work, part-time, that choose to work part-time. And then the other half are students that work evenings and Saturdays. The Paid Family Medical Leave Act cannot be rolled out like the state sick and safe time. Currently, sick and safe time is abused. People accrue enough hours, and then they're off. There's no scaling for big business or small business, and no scaling for full-time or part-time. Who covers the shift in a small business when somebody's off? For us, it's me or my wife. If we're off that day, then we're on. Otherwise, we have to call someone in, we pay that person to work, and then we pay the person to be off. We don't need the state to make it more expensive to do business in Minnesota. We already have constant rising prices with food suppliers, landlords, utilities, insurance, and wages. We'd like to be able to give good employees raises. So don't be the straw that breaks our back. Owatonna has done great things with the downtown, with streetscape, and with the high school. It's a great community, and we're a great shop in the community for a community space. But we need to be able to prosper as well. We hear that we're needed in the downtown with the small businesses, but we need to be able to prosper as well. What would be the succession plan for taking over a small business? Who'd want to run them? Who'd want to buy a small business with these taxes and expenses? I urge you to kill or at least modify this bill with consideration for full-time, part-time, or small business and big business. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Amy Jo Marks will be on Zoom, and on deck will be Kim Lewis. Amy Jo Marks, if you can identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, I'm Amy Jo Marks. I own three businesses in Winona, Minnesota. The first business I opened 21 years ago and have weathered the recession, COVID, and all the things. The other two businesses I was able to open because of the success of my first business. I employ about 70 to 80 people, mostly college students, but I do have about 10 full-time employees. Before any of this came up, I had already offered paid vacation for my full-time employees. We now added on the ESSL, which is required. I offered simple IRA match of 4%, bonuses during busy season. Small businesses cannot afford to offer health insurance and things like that. I can barely afford it for myself. So I think the most important thing and point I want to get across here is that right now for small businesses, especially speaking from food service, is that our expenses have gone up so incredibly much in the last 3 to 4 years that it is getting to the point where we are getting squeezed so bad that many are not going to be around in a year or two. And so I think it's so important to know that we are the fabric of these smaller communities. We donate the most. We help the most. We are part of what keeps everybody together. And so I want you to know the love and care that many of the small business owners put into their business and their community and their staff, that adding on these higher, we've had minimum wage go up, which didn't affect me because I was already larger, but I've talked to other small businesses that went from $8.85 to $11.13 and how that impacted them, adding on the ESSL. I mean, when I added all this up, it's $60,000 more out of my pocket. Now, I don't make that much money. So for me to have to come up with that much more money, it means increasing my prices, which means that we are putting a exhaustion on our customer for
Ms. Marks, pricing. if you can wrap it up, please.
Yep. We're putting an exhaustion on everybody regarding expenses and demands of what we need to offer. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. And next up will be Kim Lewis. And on deck will be Brian Smith. You can identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Chair Baker, and committee members. My name is Kim Lewis, and I'm here today on behalf of several organizations. the Minnesota School Boards Association, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, and finally the Minnesota Rural Education Association. Together, our organizations are responsible for the governance and management of all 331 school districts across Minnesota. Our organizations and many of our colleagues on the human resource side appreciate and support the provision in the A1 amendment today to split the paid leave premium 50-50. The current law is unclear, and the amendment provides much needed clarity. The clarification for a 50-50 split allows districts to better predict costs and allow for more accurate long-term budget planning. School districts need to maintain fiscal responsibility, and deviating from a set contribution model complicates this. From an administrative efficiency perspective, a uniform legislatively defined contribution simplifies payroll and administrative processes. Negotiating potential individual contribution rates across multiple bargaining units increases administrative burdens, and it brings about the potential for errors. We like to ensure an equitable application of the law. A standardized contribution ensures all employees are treated equitably, regardless of their bargaining unit. Varying contribution rates could lead to perceptions of unfairness or create internal disputes. Our organizations appreciate the author hearing our concern and addressing it in this amendment, and I thank you all for your time today.
Thank you for that. Next up will be Brian Smith, and Dan Klassen will be on deck. If you can identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Hello, and thank you, Chair Baker and members of the committee. My name is Brian Smith. I currently own and operate the Jersey Mike's Subs franchise in St. Paul, as well as co-owning three other stores in Fridley and Edina. Thank you for the opportunity to be able to testify today. I opened my first store in 2018 and continued to work in store during the height of the COVID pandemic. I'm responsible for 20 employees per location, all of which I have gotten to know personally and work with on a daily basis in store behind the counter. Every day, my time is spent ensuring their livelihood, safety, and stability of my business. However, operating a business in Minnesota can become increasingly difficult. We survived the COVID pandemic, increase in mandates, only to face the rise in sales taxes, crime, an ongoing workforce shortage, and a series of business mandates that have us raising our operating costs. It's becoming harder to keep our doors open. Minnesota's paid family and medical leave program, while well-intentioned, has added to these challenges. As a business owner, I feel my perspective wasn't considered when drafting these policies. There was little consideration for how business models differ across industries, and instead of crafting law that takes this into account, we have a one-size-fits-all policy that treats my business model the same as much larger companies. There's been limited communication from the state about the program specifics, and I'm left wondering how I'll manage this change by January 1st of 2026. Running my business requires my full attention. I'm responsible for every aspect of my business, from human resources to payroll to hiring to training employees, inventory management to ensuring food safety, and in adding an expansive program to administer without proper runway is overwhelming. I want to thank you, Chair Baker, for your work on the one-year delay to Minnesota's paid family and medical leave program. This extension would provide the time needed to implement the program properly. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up will be Dan Klassen and Mary Jo.
Well done.
Melcha? We'll be on deck. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. Mr. Chair Baker and members of the committee, my name is Dan Klassen, and I'm with Store Operations Director for Kowalski's Markets. Kowalski's is a proud Minnesota company, Minnesota-based company that was founded in 1983 in St. Paul by Jim and Marianne Kowalski. Despite competing against larger established chains, they built a successful business and a household name throughout the region by offering distinctive brand and elevated shopping experience. Today, Kowalski's operates 11 stores in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. I'm here to express our support for the House File 1976, particularly the portions in the amendment dealing with the needed clarification of the payroll tax sharing between employer and employee.
Kowalski's has been a unionized employer since 1983 and has offered negotiated leave plans for our employees for many years. However, the paid family and medical leave law will significantly increase our costs while subjecting our employees with a lower quality leave benefit. Additionally, under the new law, employees will no longer be able to work within our company to develop personalized leave plans. Instead, the process would be administered by a state staffed in personal 1-800 number, which could lead to confusion and reduce service quality. Adding confusion to our unionized business, the paid leave law does not address to how the new leave requirements interacts with collective bargaining agreements. The current language leaves the issue unclear. We believe the intent of the legislation is to create a 50-50 cost split between employee and employer, and we appreciate the amendment language that would clarify this responsibility. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to share our thoughts and respectfully ask that you support this important legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Klassen. Mary Jo, if you could identify yourself and proceed. Next on deck will be Aaron Dittmer Thompson.
Good morning, Chair Baker and members of the committee. My name is Mary Jo Malika, and I live in New Brighton, and I'm a leader with ISAIAH. I'm here this morning to speak in opposition to House File 1976. I have personal experiences of what it is like to need paid family and medical leave and not have the benefit. The first time I needed it, I was working for a small business in a low-wage job, and due to a medical event, was physically unable to work for several months after the birth of my first child. I was fired because I chose to obey my doctor's orders and did not return to work on the date my boss demanded. This put severe financial strain on my young family, and the mental and emotional strain made it that much more difficult for me to recover in a timely manner. I was delighted when the PFML bill was signed into law in 2023. And now members of the Minnesota House have presented HF 1976 to modify the law, to limit its scope and weaken its benefits, shutting out some working Minnesotans completely and in other cases drastically limiting the benefits of the program. Reducing the maximum time off to 6 weeks for employees working for small businesses while allowing employees of larger businesses to have 12 weeks off is not equitable treatment of Minnesota employees. Cutting leave for workers at a small business with 50 or fewer employees would hurt over 1 million Minnesotans, or 41% of our workforce. Furthermore, changing the weekly benefit amount to a flat 67% would take away much needed income from our lowest wage earners. It will leave many low-wage workers out because they won't be able to afford to take the leave that does not allow them to make ends meet. HF 1976 is an affront to all Minnesotans as it takes a chainsaw to a widely popular, well-designed, much-needed, and imminent program. I urge you to reject this cruel bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And next will be Aaron Dittmer Thompson, and on deck will be Damon Schuler. If you will identify yourself and please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Baker, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Thompson. I am an English teacher. Excuse me. I haven't used a sick day in a minute. Good morning, Chair Baker, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Thompson, and I'm an English teacher at Egan High School and the mother of a 10-month-old daughter named Judy. I am here this morning imploring you to ensure union workers have access to the Minnesota paid leave law this January, along with every other worker in Minnesota. It's simply not true that workers are sitting on hundreds of hours of time off, as we've heard in previous testimony about this law from school business officials. I had 10 days of paid maternity leave. When I began teaching 7 years ago in Champaign, Illinois, a veteran teacher took me aside and asked if I was going to have kids. She told me, "Your sick days aren't sick days. That's your future maternity leave. You can stay home when your kids are grown." So I saved my days. My husband, Nick, defended his dissertation and accepted a job in Minnesota. We packed up our house in Illinois, I applied for my Minnesota teacher's license, and I lost all those saved days in the move. It's back to square one. When we decided to start our family, I had trouble conceiving. Anyone who struggled with infertility knows that means a lot of appointments. I effectively had to choose between taking days to navigate my PCOS and saving days for a future maternity leave. When I finally got pregnant, I had 12 sick days. You can bet I guarded those days jealously. I delayed doctor-recommended care throughout my pregnancy. When we learned Judy was breech, I couldn't avoid using sick time. As I was in the hospital for an ECV, an incredibly painful procedure, I was sitting in the waiting room stressed out that I was burning a day of leave. After Judy was born by emergency C-section, I had 10 days, five of them were in the hospital. We have a teacher shortage. If we care about retaining, attracting and retaining good teachers in Minnesota, we need to treat them with dignity and respect.
Thank you, Mrs. Thompson. Next will be Damon Schuler, and on deck will be Barb Weckman-Brecky.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Please identify yourself and then proceed.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 1976. My name is Damon Schuler, and I am the owner and CFO of Shakopee Brew Hall and Coffee House located in downtown Shakopee. We have 28 employees, and one is full-time. All my employees... Most of my employees are, this is their second job, their second income, and they're part-time. And if they have any issues, I let them take off whenever they can. Our establishment is part of a vibrant and historical downtown community where small businesses like ours form the backbone of the local economy. Every day we serve our neighbors, create jobs, and contribute to the unique character that makes Shakopee special. However, as a small business owner, I can tell you firsthand that we face mounting challenges from the increasing number of mandates placed on businesses like mine. The current structure of the Minnesota paid leave law presents significant operational and financial burdens that threaten our ability to remain viable. I fully support House File 1976 because it provides several modifications that would help small businesses like mine navigate these challenges. First, the increase from 30 to 50. Like I said, I have 28 employees. As I get close to that, close to 30, I would have to let somebody go if I didn't want to have the increased expenses and financial burden. In downtown Shakopee, our small business community is interdependent, and when one shop struggles, we all feel it. I want to be clear that I support providing appropriate benefits to employees, but how we implement these programs matters greatly. The modifications proposed in this House File 1976 represent a more balanced approach that recognizes the realities faced by small businesses. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Next will be Barb Brecky, and on deck will be Darren Brook. If you can identify yourself and please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Baker and committee. My name is Barb Weckman-Brecky, and I'm a Scott County Commissioner. I'm here representing the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, as well as Scott County. Counties understand and support strong paid leave programs for employees. To be clear, we are not trying to undo what has already passed, but we do believe there are important changes that need to be made in order for this program to be implemented successfully and work as intended. To ensure our employees can meet their personal and family needs, counties have negotiated and worked in good faith with employees and their labor union representatives to develop and be early adopters of paid leave programs that include paid time off, short-term leave, long-term leave, and sick and vacation time. But the new paid leave benefit was made and placed on top of, rather than in coordination with, existing collectively bargained agreements, which has caused some issues. This bill addresses many of those. Three changes included in the amendment provide much-needed clarifications and fixes that are outlined in more detail in the letter from MICA and AMC. These changes are simple and straightforward and include mandating a 50-50 premium split between employers and employees, like most paid leave programs in other states, exempting elected officials from paid leave, just like they're exempted from ESST, and exempting extremely part-time workers like election judges who may be paying into the program and are likely receiving the benefit from other work. Counties have been good partners with our public employees, and we appreciate them. And we will continue to support having strong employee and employer-friendly paid leave programs. But when a program of this size becomes law, we have to make sure that it can be implemented and delivered effectively without creating new administrative burdens that require fixes down the road. There are provisions in this bill that helps accomplish that. We look forward to continuing our work with Chair Baker and members of both parties to identify solutions as this session progresses. And we would ask that you keep counties and implementation questions in mind as you work toward the path forward. Thank you.
Thank you. And next we'll have Darren Brook and Lauren Schotthorst will be on deck.
Good morning. My name is Darren Brook and I represent Clay County. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today regarding the financial impact of the Minnesota paid leave on Clay County. For the past 20 years, I've been employed in the area of human resources management. And for the last 14 years, I have served as the HR director for Clay County, and I'm currently the assistant county administrator. So I have followed the developments of the paid leave closely for these past years. Clay County currently employs about 690 individuals who serve our community in various essential capacities. Projections are if paid leave goes into effect as written at a contribution rate of 0.44%, it will cost the county taxpayers over $222,000. These increasing costs place an additional financial burden on our county budget, requiring us to make difficult decisions regarding resource allocation and service delivery. I also urge this committee to advocate for a clean 50-50 split in contribution rates between employers and employees while allowing employers the option to contribute more if they choose. One of the primary reasons for advocating a uniform 50-50 split is the complexity of an administrative burden of negotiating different tax rates for various bargaining units. In Clay County, we have 9 different bargaining units, all of which are up for contract negotiations this year. If the contribution structure remains negotiable, we will be required to separately negotiate the paid leave tax rate with each bargaining unit, a process that will consume significant time and resources for both the county and the unions. This is unnecessary. Complication will most likely delay the implementation of the contract and increase in administrative and legal costs. Beyond negotiations, programming for HR payroll systems to accommodate different tax rates for different bargaining units presents another significant challenge. Reprogramming of our HR payroll system to allow such variations could cost over $4,000 to be implemented. That is an additional expense placed on taxpayers simply to accommodate a lack of uniformity. A standard 50-50 split would eliminate this burden, ensuring an efficient and cost-effective implementation of the paid leave. I strongly urge this committee to consider a mandatory 50-50 split in contributions with an option for employees to contribute more if they choose. We respectfully request the flexibility to provide those counties.
Thank you, Mr. Brook. Thank you. Next will be Lauren Schotthorst and Emily Roussam will be on deck. If you identify yourself, please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schotthorst, and I'm a policy director with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, a statewide organization representing more than 6,300 businesses and 500,000 employees across the state. Thank you for the opportunity to continue this committee's conversation on the impact that one-size-fits-all paid leave mandates have on Minnesota's business community. For many of the reasons you have already heard and will continue to hear from our partners today, our members support legislation modifying the paid family medical leave mandate. During the last biennium, the chamber testified on numerous occasions seeking to address and modify the scope of the mandate, provide our smallest businesses with some relief from the financial impact and operational impacts of it, reduce the burdens of the onerous compliance requirements, and ensure that employers have the flexibility to manage these new requirements in ways that are feasible and not cost prohibitive. Changes are still necessary to address some of these issues and prevent the unintended consequences we will believe will happen under the new law. We believe that reasonable modifications to the program start date, the weekly benefit amount, annual premium adjustments, the total number of weeks, the definition of family member and seasonal workers, and the treatment of small businesses, among others, should still be pursued. These modifications are a sensible and responsible approach to achieving the goal of increasing affordable access to paid family medical leave and a functional state-run system. It is not too late to pursue this path. The Chamber believes that employment-related policy should be balanced, that benefits both workers and employers as well as taxpayers and enables our economy to grow. We appreciate that many of the recommendations the business community has advocated for, both before and after enactment, are included in House File 1976, and look forward to continuing our work to make sure that paid leave works for employers and employees. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next will be Emily Russom, and on deck will be Mindy Fredrickson. If you can identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in strong support of this bill, delaying the paid family medical leave. My name is Emily Russom. I'm a senior director of human resources with Revo. We're the managed service provider for Infinite Health Collaborative, which includes Twin Cities Orthopedics and Women's Health. We employ approximately 3,000 employees in Minnesota across our multiple locations and 6 ambulatory surgery centers. Following the pandemic, the healthcare industry, particularly in Minnesota, is facing severe staffing shortages along with staff burnout and stress. Since January 1 of 2024, we've layered on operational challenges on top of this due to Minnesota Earned Sick and Safe Time. These challenges impact cost and patient safety. Just yesterday, one of our surgery centers, we had 3 surgical techs call in sick. This required 2 employees to be pulled out of orientation where they were learning other areas to be able to support our physicians and our cases, causing us to have to delay other cases. There have been other instances where we've had to turn away patients who are scheduled for emergent issues such as miscarriages and retinal detachments. These are serious health issues, and the patient may have no other choice other than to seek emergency room care, which is more costly to our healthcare system. These are the challenges already in place. This doesn't even get to Minnesota paid family leave. In addition, we are a large employer, as most are in Minnesota in the healthcare industry. We have more than 50 employees. We already comply with the Family Medical Leave Act, which requires 12, not the 20 weeks. We are just asking for this 1-year delay to allow us, as well as other employers, along with DEED, to partner together to come up with solutions that make sense. This, in turn, allows us to remain a leader in the healthcare industry. Thank you to the committee and Chairman Baker for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Next will be Mindy Fredrickson on Zoom. If you can identify yourself and please proceed.
Good morning, Chairman Baker and members of the committee. Thank you for taking time to listen to my concerns today about the paid family medical leave. My name is Mindy Fredrickson. My husband and I own and operate Gunflint Lodge in Cook County. We're a small family-owned lakeside resort that is celebrating our 100th year in business this year. And I'm also a board member of Hospitality Minnesota. I'm here today just to share my support for House File 1976, modifying the paid family medical leave law. Well, we support modifying the law to standardize the seasonal hospitality exemption, as well as changing the weeks of leave available based on business size and modifying the expansive definition of family member. Staffing a hospitality business, and especially a seasonal business, is one of the biggest challenges we face now. As you can imagine, that challenge increases exponentially when you're trying to staff in a remote location like the Gunflint Trail, where we're hours away from any major population center. We house all of our employees on site, and there are no temporary staffing agencies. The PFML law needs to be amended because the seasonal employer and seasonal employee definitions in the existing law do not have the same day duration. In the existing law, a seasonal employer is one who earns 2/3 of its revenue in 180 days, but seasonal employees are defined as employees who are employed by a single employer for 150 days. This 30-day gap between the definition of seasonal employers and seasonal employees will leave seasonal employers like seasonal resorts understaffed for 30 days during our busiest season in the calendar year. And we're not in a situation where we would be able to replace or temporarily staff for those positions. We would just be understaffed or in some cases forced to close. Small family owned and operated businesses and seasonal a resource like ours would also benefit by capping the maximum leave an employee can take in any year to 6 weeks. Again, most of our revenue is made in a very short summer season, and we don't have
Ms. Frederickson?
Yes.
Thank you. If you can read to wrap it up, we have to keep moving.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking my testimony and consideration to this bill.
Thank you. Next, we'll have Emily Thompson, who is on Zoom as well. If you can identify yourself and proceed.
Dear Chair and committee members, my name is Emily Strike Thompson, and I'm a special education teacher at Wilmer Public Schools. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. This bill, as amended, would hurt union workers. Employees under collective bargaining agreements would be excluded from accessing this benefit in January. Teachers are counting on this leave to be available to use next year. Teachers such as myself, who may have to put plans to expand their families on hold if this bill passes as amended. The law currently on the books supports workers and supports our families. The amended language of the proposed bill, however, punishes workers for having a union and makes public sector strikes more likely. The language states that not only do we have to be on a new contract to get the benefit, but that we still will not be covered unless both parties agree to go half on the premium and that workers should be covered at all. This largely takes away the ability to bargain over the split, and a public employer could hang up bargaining if they insist on an uneven split or simply refuse to identify workers as covered. If the parties reached an impasse on this, the union could end up on strike. And I want to remind the committee that strikes have a much bigger impact on public services than individuals using leave time to care for a loved one or have a baby. The author of this bill, who I am a constituent of, states on his website that he cares about our kids and he fully believes we need to invest in all our schools here in Minnesota. As an educator and a parent of a young child, I share the same belief. However, Chair Baker, this bill is not an investment in our schools or the children of this state. It will not help keep parents who are also teachers in the education profession. It will not benefit our kids who are already greatly affected by the teacher shortage and whose parents should be able to take paid leave to take care of them if needed. Lastly, I also want to point out that cutting the family definition hurts rural and non-traditional families. Research shows that the need for caregiving leave is higher in rural Minnesota, while access is less. By narrowing the definition of caregiver, this bill hurts rural families and anyone who is in a caregiving situation but doesn't meet the other one prescribed definition. All workers in Minnesota are counting on accessing this program in January if they need it. I urge you to be compassionate and consider the needs of your constituents and people of Minnesota over profit margins. Please vote no on House File 1976. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we testifier will be Dana Bacon, and on deck will be Alexandra Fitzsimmons. If you can identify yourself and please proceed.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dana Bacon. I'm Senior Director of State Government Affairs for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, and I live in Rosemount. Wanted to come this morning and talk about concerns we have with House File 1976. Thinking about what our cancer patients go through, the type of care that they need to survive their diagnoses often runs months, if not years. And so seeing this bill shorten paid leave for 6 weeks for small businesses, seeing it redefine family, and seeing it change the scale of wage maintenance gives us pause, to say the least. Thinking about a person who gets a diagnosis of acute lymphocytic leukemia, for example, they're going to undergo an induction phase of about a month of intense chemotherapy, consolidation that runs several months, again, more chemotherapy, and maintenance that can run about 2 years. The thought that we would shorten their leave access to 6 weeks basically says that depending upon who you work for, you may not have the leave you need to fully recover from your care. I mean, getting them back to where they work is simply not an option. And so for us at the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, we want to put our patients first and see the bill that we supported that's now a law. Stay put. I mean, there's a lot of risk in getting this legislation through the way it's drafted. We think you should take a step back and reconsider. Thank you.
Thank you. Next will be Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and after that we will have Corey Gentleman on Zoom. If you can identify yourself and please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Senior Policy Director with Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. CDF Minnesota advocates for policies and programs that improve the well-being of children while focusing specifically on the needs of Black, Indigenous, and children of color in Minnesota. We have been actively advocating for paid family medical leave with our coalition partners for more than a decade because it's a three-generational approach that supports healthy child development and family stability. I'm here to speak in opposition to House File 1976. That being said, Chair Baker, we share common beliefs and values surrounding the vocations of parenting and caregiving. Whether a family is welcoming a new baby, caring for a sick child, or tending to an ill parent, Children's Defense Fund fervently believes caregivers should be able to temporarily shift their focus from earning income to bonding with their infant, holding their child's hand while an IV is placed, and being fully present with their aging parent who is in hospice. Addressing and supporting both the needs of children and their parents and their caregivers results in healthier outcomes for Minnesota's youngest members and their families. Paid family medical leave will strengthen bonding and foster secure attachment between parents and their infants, support the healthy growth and development of children, promote family connectedness, especially during times of crisis and uncertainty, reduce stress and financial strain on parents and caregivers, and finally, maintain employment continuity and family economic security. We have two main concerns with House File 1976. We fear that these two changes would increase stress and strain on families and undermine their economic stability. First, by exempting certain employees, the bill pushes out otherwise eligible working families from accessing paid leave benefits, benefits which would provide basic needs for financially unstable families. Likewise, decreasing the benefit amount for some eligible families will cause financial hardship, again at a critical time, and again undermining the economic security of families and ultimately the well-being of children. We know that Minnesotans value the vocations of parenting and family caregiving. We respectfully urge you to maintain the current parent family medical leave law as it is and vote against House File 1976. Thank you for your consideration and for putting children at the center of your discussion.
Thank you. Next will be Corey Genelin via Zoom, and on deck will be Justin Turch also via Zoom. If you can identify yourself and please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Corey Genelin. I am the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Society for Human Resource Management. MnSHRM is in support of House File 1976, specifically the limitation of benefits to 6 weeks for small employers. I ask you to consider persons who are not named in the Minnesota Paid Family Medical Leave Act, but who are nonetheless affected by it. The statute addresses employees who need time off of work and the employers who must provide it. I encourage the committee to consider three other classes of persons, specifically the other employees who must remain in the workplace, the customers who are relying on the products and services provided by the employer, and the unemployed or underemployed Minnesotan who would love a chance to step in and fill the position of a worker who was unable to work. I'll illustrate this with an example from my law practice. I represent one of the biggest nursing home companies in Minnesota. This is a large employer subject to the federal FMLA, which requires 12 weeks of leave. My client had a kitchen manager who had an unspecified blood disorder. Her doctors didn't know exactly what was wrong or how long she would be off work. While my client had many employees, it had only one kitchen manager, and it needed to make do without her for an unknown period of time. That period of time did end up being more than 12 weeks. Because it was a large employer, my client was able to ask other kitchen managers from other facilities to cover for this missing employee. But that meant overtime and extra work that those employees did not want. It meant that the seniors living in this facility were one step closer to not having a professional overseeing their nutrition. It also meant that if there was a Minnesotan looking for work as a kitchen manager, my client could not hire that person because it had to be ready to reinstate the sick employee if she got better. Employers with less than 50 employees are far less able to deal with this situation, and limiting their liability for paid leave will benefit their working employees, their customers who rely on them, and Minnesotans who are looking for work and eager to fulfill the duties of Minnesotans unable to work. I ask that you approve this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Genelin. Next will be Justin Turch via Zoom, and after that will be Sarah Gangelhoff on deck. Thank you. If you identify yourself and please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Justin Turch. I'm an HR consultant based in Duluth, Minnesota. As part of my job, I work on a continuous and regular basis with businesses who employ between 10 and 100 employees, most of whom can't afford a full-time HR position. As I've shared before with this committee, HR people are not pro-employer. We're not pro-employee. We're pro-employment. As an HR professional, I recognize the importance of paid family medical leave in supporting workers and their families, and I'm happy that we have started the discussion on a program that will fit. At the same time, I also see firsthand the heavy burden financially and administratively that small businesses face in complying with this law. Without the adjustments provided in the House File 1976, many of these businesses will be forced to make difficult decisions, cutting back hours, delaying hiring, or reducing other critical benefits to their staff just to absorb the cost. Right now, many small business owners are already struggling to keep up with rising costs, regulations, and workforce shortages. The added challenge of navigating a rigid, one-size-fits-all system would be overwhelming. House File 1976 offers much-needed flexibility, allowing these businesses to retain employees, manage their costs, and continue offering competitive benefits without being pushed to the breaking point. A strong paid leave program and a thriving small business sector are not mutually exclusive. This bill ensures that both can succeed. I urge the committee to support House File 1976 and give Minnesota small businesses and their employees the tools they need to comply with the law without compromising their ability to operate and grow. Thank you for your time, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you. Next up will be Sarah Gengeloff with Lisa Schaefer on deck. If you will identify yourself and please proceed.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Gengeloff, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and Innovation at the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. We're part of the coalition that supported paid leave, and we're here today to oppose HF 1976. In the past 42 years, we have invested more than $54 million in communities across Minnesota and advanced policy to create a state where women, girls, and their families thrive. And we're concerned about this bill's impact on them. Like many who have spoken, we are worried about the reduction of leave time proposed in this bill. For those who take paid leave to recover from childbirth, take time for safety issues, and for caregiving, the proposed reductions create insufficient time to address the physical and mental and emotional challenges they may face. For example, the most common time for postpartum depression onset is between 4 and 8 weeks after delivery. This bill does not take into account the complexity or diversity of recovery experiences. Women also perform the majority of uncared and paid caregiving for the sick and disabled in Minnesota and have for decades had to choose between caregiving and working. Women with access to adequate paid leave are significantly more likely to return to their previous jobs and to maintain their pre-leave wages. They're able to build more experience in their jobs and maintain jobs that match their expertise. This can raise their earnings and help close the gender pay gap. These benefits should be available to workers regardless of the size of their employer's business or whether or not they're union members, with enough time to allow for flexibility for healing and caring for themselves and others. It's time to move forward with paid leave as passed, and we ask that you not support HF 1976. Thank you.
Thank you. Next will be Lisa Schaefer with Emily Myatt on deck. If you can identify yourself and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Lisa Schaefer, and I'm the HR Director for the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm grateful for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1976. As an organization, the League provides HR assistance to our 841 member cities throughout the state. As cities prepare for the new Minnesota paid leave program, we have been fielding many questions regarding administrative and budgetary challenges as we quickly approach the implementation date. First, cities support the additional language designating the premium split as 50% city and 50% employee. Current statute requires the employer to cover a minimum of 50% of the premium, with the remaining portion to be covered by the employee. That statutory language has been interpreted to mean the city must bargain and achieve agreement with the unions in order for the city to only pay the 50% premium. Cities typically already provide generous sick and paid leave benefits, and adding this additional requirement to bargain the premium split with unions has a compounding effect on city budgets and taxpayers. Second, cities support language requiring an employee to work over 80 hours to qualify. This would make it clear that certain very short-term positions, for example, election judges, would not be charged premiums. Some cities hire hundreds of election judges for each election on a very short-term basis, and this exemption would greatly reduce the administrative burden for determining eligibility. Third, cities support language that would remove elected official positions from qualifying for Minnesota paid leave. City mayors and council members often receive stipends. However, they are not typically subject to minimum wage, overtime requirements, or are considered employees in many other respects. It is unclear how paid leave would be administered in these circumstances. That concludes my testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Baker. We thank you for your meaningful work on these provisions.
Thank you. Next will be Emily Myatt, and on deck will be Angela. Angela, I'm going to go with that. I'm not even going to try. Go ahead and identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name's Emily Myatt. I'm the Government Relations Director of the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, the nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy affiliate of the American Cancer Society. I'm also here today as a steering committee member of the Minnesota Cancer Alliance, a coalition of more than 100 organizations committed to supporting Minnesota's patient survivors and caregivers. We are here today to respectfully oppose House File 1976. And I want to speak primarily to two provisions. The first is concerns around cutting the maximum amount of leave. So many in this room have seen a loved one, a friend, or maybe even yourself go through cancer treatment and diagnosis. Can involve serious surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, and unfortunately the time needed for that treatment and recovery doesn't change depending on your employer's size. We believe all Minnesotans, regardless of employer size, should have access to the same benefits and the same amount of leave. We also oppose the change to the family member definition. Oftentimes caregiving looks a little bit different than the traditional family structure, and because of that we think all working caregivers should also have the time off from work to take care of loved ones that are going through cancer treatment or diagnosis. Wanted to make sure that cancer patients, survivors, and caregivers are part of the conversation today and their voices are heard. And so we would encourage you to support them and respectfully ask you to vote no on efforts to weaken Minnesota's paid leave program. Thank you.
Thank you. Next will be Angela Schweznettel.
Thank you so much.
And our final testifier we have pre-listed here would be Sean Petplace on Zoom. If you can go ahead and identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, my name is Angela Schweznettel, and I run Moon Palace Books, a small bookstore in South Minneapolis where I live. I've been open since 2012, and I have 5 full-time employees and 2 part-time employees. And I just wanted to tell the story today about a couple of years ago how my store manager, Heidi's father, died. He had Parkinson's, and we knew that he wasn't going to live much longer, and made a plan for Heidi to take time off so that she could be there with him and her family. I didn't want her to worry about money, and I didn't want her to feel like she had to quit the store or that there was a limit to how much time she could spend with him before he died. And I had set aside money to pay her while she took time off. Even with all of our planning, it ended up being more than we expected. Most people live 5 to 7 days without food and water, but her dad lived for another 21 days. And I think Heidi ended up needing to take off about 6 weeks total. I would have loved to have paid family leave that wasn't dependent on me having a good year or planning ahead and only having one employee that needed time off. I can't imagine how it would have felt to have to say that I couldn't do it because I didn't have enough money or to tell her that she needed to come back to work before she was ready. I would want to be able to take time off if someone in my family got sick, and it shouldn't depend on me having enough money or wanting to do the right thing. I just want people to understand that there are small businesses like mine that need the paid family and medical leave program as it was passed, and that we can't wait. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And our final testifier will be Sean Petplace on Zoom. If you could identify yourself and please proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Baker and members of the House Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development and Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Sean Petplace, and I'm the National Campaigns Director for the Main Street Alliance. We represent over 1,500 small business owners in Minnesota and oppose House File 1976. In our concept brief entitled How Main Street Fights for and Wins Paid Leave, several members shared why passage of paid family medical leave was a win for Minnesota small businesses. Coffee shop owner Andrew Coplin couldn't afford to pay his employees when serious illness struck. Fighting to keep their jobs open left us as small business owners financially and emotionally drained, and our employees with inadequate time to recover and care for themselves. MSA member Cassie Sawyer tried to purchase commercial insurance policies to cover her income in the event of a disability, but all insurers that she reached out to would not offer for a business such as hers. Lastly, as a self-employed hairstylist, Renee Herskovitz testified in support of the bill previously because as a self-employed trade worker, you know, she actually injured her arm cutting the hair of somebody and couldn't take the time to recover in lead up to working to help pass the bill originally. So what I would say is cutting leave for workers of small businesses with 50 or fewer employees would hurt over 1 million Minnesotans. 41% of the workforce would see their leave capped at just 6 weeks. And that helps, that actually hurts small employers who would be at a further competitive disadvantage. And one thing I would just say is DEA is ready. They're working on this. They are ready to implement the law. And we look forward to working with them to make it happen. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That wraps up those that had pre-signed up. Is there anybody from public that would like to testify? Seeing none, we will now move to member questions. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Baker, for I am glad we're finally starting to have the conversation and I think a more productive way about specific things that you'd like to see changed in the current law for paid family medical leave. I still don't agree that we need to change anything at this moment, but I do appreciate that we're actually having the conversation. And I noted that many of the multiple of the testifiers mentioned that they wanted a delay, and I don't think you want a delay. Is that that's a question? That's one question.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier, if we can work on significant reform to something currently, I don't want to delay it. Let me be clear about that. I think if we do this, some significant changes, I think that I wrote this bill so actually the deed wouldn't be, you know, all messed up with a lot of new policy and changes. I try to make this, we actually get this out yet next year with significant changes made to my bill.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Baker, for that clarification. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, many of the comments that I've heard or this general theme is about one size fits all, that this is a one size fits all bill. And I have continued to push back against that because I don't believe this is a one-size-fits-all bill. And the reason is because there's multiple exemptions in this bill. Independent contractors are exempted. Self-employed folks are exempted. Certain seasonal workers are exempted. There's grants for small businesses, and there's also a premium reduction for small businesses. That doesn't sound like a one-size-fits-all. In fact, that was multiple months, years of negotiations with corporate, with small businesses to work this out so that it wasn't a one-size-fits-all bill. And then the other thing that I hear is this is about right-sizing. But then when I look at the bill and I heard testimony, right-sizing means people get paid less when they're on leave. People get less amount of time to be on leave. And you're also requiring that all labor groups have to collectively bargain to be a part of this program. Now, if we thought negotiating a 50% premium was going to be a problem, now we're talking about negotiating whether or not those groups would actually be in the program. And, oh, boy, you will see problems at those organizations. If they thought they had a problem now, they're going to have a problem trying to negotiate the entire program with local labor groups. So I think the problem here is that this current bill is going to cause more problems than what I think you are intending to cause. It's going to, I mean, and also in this bill, you are, one of the provisions will actually require small business to pay higher premiums. And I don't know if that was intended, but it was intended?
It was intended.
All right. That, I don't understand how that helps small businases. And then lastly, because I know other members I'll make one final comment, is that if you are lessening this benefit for small businesses, it makes them less competitive. And I just don't understand how that makes Minnesota better when we're thinking about if we're looking at protecting the most prized assets for corporations and for businesses, it is the workers. And if we are taking away a benefit that is currently the law now and will take effect in several months, we are making it a tougher economic environment and a tougher worker competitive environment for those employers by doing this, especially considering what's happened at the federal level and a certain uncertainty that we have.
Chair Baker?
Mr. Chair, I guess if I could comment to a couple of those things that Representative Frazier had said. I think you bring up some very good points. Yeah, the employer part of this that I increased on the employer was to get to the point that the DFL was demanding that we make sure we include everybody. So to go down from a 12-week to a 6 weeks is a reduction in their leave of a person away from the job under this program. They could still take some paid PTO time or sick leave if they have that accumulated. But I also felt it was more fair then so that there isn't more of a burden on the system. That was thought through, but it's still at the end, I think, still a better deal for the small employer because they will lose workers out of the workforce less. Again, they can still use their PTO if they want to use that. You talked a little bit about collective bargaining. That's very important to me in this bill. But the DFL completely circumvented CBOs and CBAs all the whole time. You went around the whole thing because you didn't give them a chance to sit down with the employers and at least talk about this. All this bill does is it requires them to sit down and talk about it. If they want to be included, they're included. This is not a rehashing of everything. But what they have to do, and if you've heard through the counties and the school districts, they're saying, let us have a conversation so that if you want the whole thing, like it is, we'll take it. But then we have to also then, how does this line up with other benefits that they're already getting? It forces that conversation. That's what this bill does. They can be included. This is not meant to be any kind of excluding them or not. It forces them to sit down, and that should have been in the original House file, too, to make sure that all the complexities that have gone over the years of collective bargaining should have been recognized at the next available time that they can sit down and talk about this. How does it line up? So I think you can't have it both ways. You have to kind of understand that if you want to write benefit programs for everybody, you have to make sure that they sit down and say, okay, how does that work with us? And that would be my kind of response to that. So I don't think it was a question, but I want to make sure I respond to that.
Thank you. Next, we have Representative Pete Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Mecklen, Chair Baker, for bringing the bill. I'm going to hit just that there was a lot of testimony today. There's got a lot of good notes and stuff, but just to talk about that union side of it and that 50-50 split. My understanding is the way the bill is written that it is already a 50-50 split and you can negotiate those changes if you would like to. I've been part of a lot of union negotiations, and this idea, I've never experienced it where an employer has come in and just said, sure, we'll give you that. And a lot of the testimony today is implied that they have to say yes to the negotiations. And I have never experienced that in my time of negotiations. We have sat there and punched each other in the face over 0.25% for days because we fight for every single penny. So I don't think there's misunderstanding on that. And the fact that it is open to negotiations where if my union wants to go in and give a concession somewhere else to have the employer pick up more of that tab, I think we can still have that conversation. One of the other things that got brought up is this idea that we should be able to negotiate whether or not this is in our contract. And some of the concerns I heard from a lot of the folks that are supporting this bill is that they're going to have a difficult time implementing it. And if my bargaining unit goes in and negotiates some variation of this, and then AFSCME goes in and negotiates a different variation of this, and the supervisors negotiate a different variation, and the confidential unit negotiates a different variation, the police officers, they're multiple different locals, the implementation would be absolutely brutal for our HR department. So the fact that there is this standard floor, I think, makes that implementation much easier. The last thing that I'll try and finish this with a question. If organizations or groups that are under collective bargaining agreements are paired out and have to negotiate this in, I believe it will disproportionately impact public employees because so many of our organizations, whether they be county employees, city employees, state employees, are under collective bargaining agreements. We already struggle to recruit the best and the brightest into these positions. If we carve out this benefit for those workers, how can we expect to continue to recruit against the public sector who already often pays higher wages, has some other benefits, to get folks into those positions, whether it be law enforcement, firefighting, all the public employees that we have across the state that really make everything work, that build and clear our streets, all that type of stuff. So how do we justify that major, because this is a would be a major benefit difference, because it would be extremely, extremely hard to negotiate this benefit in, and don't believe we have not tried to negotiate benefits like this in over the years.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Baker.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Johnson, for that. I think that what I heard you say initially was unions are very unique too. Some unions may want different agreements on paid family and different reasons to be flexible and changeable. That is how it is all over Minnesota for non-union businesses as well. You said it clearly. Everything is unique, but the unions at that collective bargaining table should have the decision or the process to say, what will this cost, whether it's public unions like counties and school districts, what will this cost to taxpayers? That has to be an honest question that is at the table. Right now we're hearing double-digit increases from the last county levies, school district. You know, we had record spending in school districts last year, and it still isn't enough this year. We're hearing that loud and clear. How much are we going to let taxpayers continue to take on these very large increases? And this is a very important part of this. Currently, unions have generally better benefit sets than most in the private sector. I'm not saying it's a blanket coverage, but what I've heard is St. Louis County has 1,500 hours you can bank, and that's very generous, and I'm glad they can do that. I don't want to take any of that away. But what I want to do is to make sure that the administrators that have to get to a contract and the workers have the ability to sit down and say, okay, here's what this new thing will cost us. And if they, in my bill, I say you can't negotiate the 50-50 in these settings because the cities or the businesses that have unions or the county school districts, they need to know what is the expense going to be. They have to plan on this because that's what drives their levies. So I'm just suggesting that we make sure that conversation happens, because this cost will have a major impact about what's next then and what is also available for wage increases, perhaps, or for other benefits that they might want to fight for. Because the collective bargaining agreements, I have so much respect for that. It's a huge part of Minnesota's fabric. I just want to make sure that this one-size-fits-all, this overlapping fabric that comes on top of already many other benefits that are unique to different collective bargaining agreements should be talked about before it's automatically just approved. I think this is another conversation that just has to happen at the local level.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. That gets brought up, that the impact to taxpayer, the burden that we are as workers when we try to negotiate higher wages and benefits gets brought up every single time I'm at the bargaining table, that we're forcing this upon the communities. But we are also the folks that are serving those communities. We understand the impact that we have, and we understand the value of making sure that we continue to recruit the best and the brightest. I've sat at those bargaining tables across the state and had these discussions. The one of the other things that seems to be like this underlying tone is that paid family medical leave and ESST create sick people. Mm-hmm. People have been getting sick and having babies forever. They have had to make those impossible choices of spending time with their families, with their newborns, with sick family members. This gives them an opportunity to do that. I wish I had the numbers in front of me, but the average leave numbers are not these maximum things. And when we look at a maximum of 20 weeks, that person potentially had one of the worst years of their lives. If they are taking 12 weeks for themselves and 8 weeks for a family member or vice versa, this is not a vacation. These people are having their lives drastically changed, whether that is having a child or having a sick family member. And I think that's important to keep in perspective.
Chair, I just want to comment, if I could, on just our county and school district employees are not a burden. I take a little bit of a front to that comment. But the tax burden, though, on everybody is something that we can't ignore. So please understand, we are so grateful for the truck drivers that get out in the middle of the storms and make our way to so we can get to work. There's so many good emergency responders. There's so many teachers. There's so many paraprofessionals, so many city workers that have to do this. They're not a burden. And clearly this is going to be an extension and hopefully a nice improvement of what they're getting now. To some degree that works for everybody, but not listening to those voices in the last 2 years. And I'm glad Representative Johnson and Representative Johnson, you are both here this year for the first time hearing these arguments, hearing the discussion. You're hearing the testimony. This is new to you, but not to all of us that were here the last couple of years. It's important that you hear this, and I hope that we can get serious about coming to other ideas. So if it isn't this, I invite you to come and see me because we want to work on something that does work. I do not want to hurt collective bargaining. I want to make sure they have choices. This just says you got to sit down and talk about this, but also you can't negotiate out of the 50-50 deal. That's what would likely would happen, and those taxpayers and administrators have to know to plan. They have to know what this is going to be so that it's going to be twice as much, or is it the 0.44? So that's what we need to talk about. Just want to come back to that. Thank you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we are back talking about paid family medical leave, a bill that I heard. I've only been around 4 years, and we've been talking about it 4 years. 13 years is probably longer. and I know that they've been talking about it around the country. But, you know, in our last conversation, I talked about my sister and my dad. And serendipitously, and I'll tell you that my sister does not follow us, does not watch our hearings at 8:15 in the morning. Right. She just, yeah, exactly. And I'm sure your family doesn't either. Yeah. But she's also a constituent, so when she calls, I have to return her calls. I'm a good representative, but not a great sister. She was texting me, and I happened to be sitting next to the bill author, and she asked me, and it must have been, I'm sure there's a news story, but she asked me if she'd be eligible for the state's short-term leave program. She was talking about this program. She's at a company. She's a nurse practitioner now, a company with 13 employees. Does my boss get to opt out? She has short-term disability, and she pays $150 a month, and it only covers her. So it would not, if my niece got sick, if her husband got sick, if my stepmom got sick, her mom got sick, she would not be covered. And I said, as of now, the bill we passed that will go into effect on January 1 will cover you. You'll be eligible. I think that, what are the rates? If you make $67,000 a year, it's $5.63 a week. She probably makes more than that, so let's say it's $10 a week, so it'll save her $100. It'll save her employer money, too, because her employer can't afford one of these bigger plans because there's only 13 workers. So maybe it'll be $5 a month or prorated, right, $7 a week for them. And that's what will go into effect on January 1. As we have been having this conversation, I texted her this morning. I figured she's up. And said that there's a bill on the table to cut benefits for small businesses. And she said that would cost me an extra $2,000 a year in paying my own short-term disability benefits for those weeks that I'm not covered to go from 12 to 6. It would make changes for middle-class families, shift more money and responsibility onto the workers. And it will cost my employer about $20 a month. I'm just literally reading her text to participate in the state program, but he can't afford to participate in a private program because of how small they are. Small businesses want this program too, so that they can compete for workers with big businesses. This feels like it's hijacking the narrative. That's my sister, who's a nurse practitioner, my sister who has experience as a healthcare professional, my sister who knows and understands that working for a small business doesn't mean you recover quicker from sickness. It doesn't mean you need less time to care for your child or your parent. And so I guess I'm wondering, and I actually have some wonky questions, but just in the spirit of I have to answer to my constituent, my sister, how is somebody working at a small business who under this bill will get less benefits, how will they care for their kid? And in a way any different from someone who works at a big business and gets longer benefits?
Chair Baker.
Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Greenman. I see it as your sister is going to go from 0 to 6 weeks. She's not losing anything yet because this bill hasn't rolled out yet. If I could offer 6 weeks of paid family at my small business that has about 40 employees, that is a tremendous win for my employees. I see that as a real win. 6 weeks off for paid family. What we could talk about here is maybe this level one and level two that I'm talking about, under 50, over 50, if the smaller employers that are there saying, ooh, this might not be what I want because I want to have the richer program, they should maybe be able to opt in. Because I don't want them to be at a disadvantage as well if they think that's an issue. Maybe we'll talk about how that could work so that your employer that your sister works for might want to do that because there could be a possibility that they don't want to be a lesser one. I just know for me, going from 0 to 6 is a big win. My employees that work for 10 years or more, they now get about 3 to 4 weeks off of PTO. And that's kind of what my standard has been for a number of years. This is a huge improvement to my set that I think that we can get behind, but it has to be in a way that I think is better sized for those options. So again, I see that as going, she would have 6 weeks if this law comes out the way it is, from 0. Because I don't think the plan that's going to roll out is going to really protect those small businesses to allow employees to be out as long as they'd like to be, or they could be, or you'd like to, because again, of all the tragedies we do hear, they're real, I get it. But we're allowing at least something to get on the books for 6 weeks. I think this is a terrific benefit.
Representative Greenman, I just want to remind everybody we are running shorter on time, so if we can keep it tight.
I do have a few more questions, and also this is a repeal of a bill that took 3 years to pass. So, or not a repeal, excuse me.
Thank you.
I'd say that. This significantly changes the impact it'll have on a million people of the bill we pass. And I do take issue with, I don't think it's going from 0 to 6. We passed a bill. We funded a bill. It is now law. It's been law for 2 years. We delayed it. Frankly, it is going into effect on January because of negotiations. I think that there was the original bill, and I'm sitting next to the bill author, actually was supposed to go into effect earlier. And so we're going for small businesses, for over a million folks, people work under business of 50, we're going from 12 weeks to 6. And what I heard my sister saying is, she can figure out how to get 12 weeks just for herself under a current plan. She's going to pay three times as much. And so I think, you know, some is better than nothing is not how we should govern for our workers. I think we passed 12 weeks for everybody because that's what we heard. I think there are many countries in the world that have 6 months. That's not what we're talking about. I think anybody who says, if you have a baby or if you have a baby, you're back to work at 7 weeks, or if you have a dying parent, it doesn't matter how long it's going to take them in hospice to die, but you're back a week at 6 weeks. Or as we heard from the folks with leukemia, if you get cancer, hopefully it's just not a bad cancer because you need less time. So I guess I'd say on that, I don't feel like I can go back and deliver to my sister or any of those million workers that, well, at least we preserved 6 weeks. 2 years ago, we funded it. We made it work. It's going to cost $5.37 on average a week. But we can't do this because we've somehow figured out an economy that for small businesses, we can't afford to have our workers get sick. For big businesses, it's different. And I actually think that one of the impacts of this may be, like we're seeing now, people, workforce, go to bigger businesses. We heard that in the last testimony in the delay bill. We heard people say, when people want to get pregnant or when people are anticipating long-term health challenges, they go to bigger companies that have better benefits. We don't want that. We want people to be able to stay, work locally. My sister loves working at a place with 13 employees, and so that's our job. That's government's job. And I guess I'd say we should be balancing the scales and untilting an economy that does feel very, very concentrated and focused on those biggest businesses in terms of the power in our economy. That's to my second question, I guess, which is, and this is what, before my sister was texting me, what I wanted to get at was this subdivision 7, or the section 4 subdivision 7 about outsourcing government and outsourcing the provision of determining benefits and calculating benefits in this program. And I'm wondering, one, is that what problem you're responding to by allowing a private for-profit company to do benefits determination and eligibility? And then is that a conversation you're having with Deed to solve one of their problems, or what problem are you trying to solve?
Chair Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenman, I think that's a really great question. What I'm trying to solve here is to run a program more efficiently than the government can do. So whether it's a private for-profit company, I think if we can save money in the program and execute it better than the government can, I'm all over it. And all I'm doing in the bill here is providing a choice. They can choose to do this. If Deed wants to laugh at it and just not deal with it, they don't have to do it. But I wanted to make it an option for them, because other states, Representative Greenman, have used this extremely successfully. Connecticut has used the company Aflac, and they have had the same vendor for the last 5 years since the inception. It's a flat cost. Their costs have been stable. Customer service is running very high. It was brought to me by the industry saying, hey, by the way, we can do this if you want to make it option. Deed is not asking that we want someone some choice or anything. I just thought it'd be fun, it'd be reasonable to have Deed have a choice. I think if they can do it and save money and do it better, that's how this should work. So that's why I put, that's exactly why I put it in the bill.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think my concern is that in a different committee, in the Fraud Prevention Committee, we've been having a lot of conversations about the outsourcing of government provision, provider provision to both nonprofits and for-profits. And you'll be surprised to know that your colleague, Representative Patty Anderson, and I agree that one of the things we probably need to do is think about how the lack of oversight and transparency to private companies that government and voters and elected officials don't have insight into, whether it's the algorithm, whether it's the technology, or whether it's how they're making benefits decisions, that's actually part of our problem that is making government an easy mark for fraud. So there's to me that's one level of the problem. There is also a level which is, this is not working well in the health care, in the health insurance industry. So we have, in many cases, most of our public programs have been privatized. But if you look at what's happening, you know, the DOJ sued United Health on Medicaid fraud because they were denying benefits to people that people should have gotten. We have seen government become a profit center for private for-profit companies that offer to do things. Amazon's running the back end of procurement for some companies, or for some cities and counties, and they're looking at the state. It has not made things more efficient or cheaper for taxpayers. It has made some people a lot of money, and it has been very hard to unwind, like in health care and in health insurance, because we've spent 30 years building the back-end infrastructure of health insurance companies through our public programs. And if we wanted to tomorrow administer those, we can't, because we haven't invested any in creating our own infrastructure. So this piece really concerns me, this privatization piece. And I hear you that you're saying it gives Deed an option. I think we should say, for both government transparency, for public oversight of public benefits that are going to the benefit of of the public that we should keep control to ensure that the benefits determinations, people are getting the benefits that they deserve in the time that they deserve it, and that that there is not a profit motive that somehow would interfere with that. And I think the health insurance privatization has shown that it is a boondoggle that makes it very hard to unwind when we do it. So I have a very, very a big problem with this piece of the provision, in addition to the carve-out of benefits and members. That this piece, to me, is a particular concern with this bill.
Here, I want to go back to that question. I know it wasn't a question, and I know we're running out of time. And again, I want to remind members that if we run out of time, we can open this up next week as well. So please know this is a starting point, I hope. To that question, though, I want to make sure it's clear that Deed would still be completely in charge of the system. It's still collecting the payroll tax through the reporting of UI. What it allows Deed to do, though, is to perhaps maybe contract out just the call center part of it. It might be a certain piece of it. That's what other states have done. But instead of hiring 400 employees in the state of Minnesota, maybe we hire the current 50 that there is, or maybe 80, whatever that is. But if they can hire someone else that's doing it already cheaper and better, I think it's a huge mistake if the state of Minnesota thinks they can always do things better than the private option. We learned from Minlars. We tried to build our own system, and it took a private company, MinDrive, to do it better, and we made it work. So just know that the government doesn't have all the answers, and we just got done hiring thousands and thousands of new state employees over the last 2 years. Our government is bloated. We are running out of money. What we don't need is more employees on the system if we can do it better and cheaper and still provide good benefits to our citizens. Thank you.
Can I just?
We really wouldn't need to move on. Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is Mr. Rowe in the room still? I just have a quick question for Mr. Rowe as he's coming up. Thank you, Chair Baker, for bringing a starting point of the conversation. And this has been one of the biggest things that I've heard from multiple stakeholders, from employers, but also employees. And one of the common themes that I've heard is, and we heard it today, to be honest, about limited communication, about a lack of clarity, about many questions, about uncertainty. Those were all things that, not my words, but testifiers' words. So, Mr. Rowe, I wanted to give you an opportunity to provide clarity to not only employers, but employees. So we talked previously, and contract negotiations are starting for many bargaining groups. So if you could just provide clarity with very limited time, under the current law, if an employer and a collective bargaining unit are unable to reach an agreement on the allocation of the payroll tax for paid family medical leave by January 2026, who pays what percent for the new tax?
Mr. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, and maybe I'll just to introduce myself for the record.
Yes, please.
My name is Evan Rowe, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I think in line with previous testimony, the department does not have visibility into the nature of every single collective bargaining agreement in the state of Minnesota. I do not know how those holdover provisions may or may not apply. Now, again, I think the law itself is very clear that an employer may choose to charge up to 50%, but I do not know how that would necessarily apply to every single collective bargaining agreement in the state of Minnesota, because each collective bargaining agreement may be unique and have different provisions in it, which would suggest that each collective bargaining agreement may have flexibility already built into it.
Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you. So it depends. Is basically, so Chair Baker, thank you for bringing this bill and at least attempting to provide some clarity for our employers and employees as we go into collective bargaining. So thank you for doing that. That's why I would support this.
Okay, members, because we are going to lay this over, we're going to come back Wednesday and finish this. Chair Baker, if you would
Just super briefly, Mr. Chair, I just want to say thanks to all the members and all the testifiers that came a long way to come down and share your thoughts. This is all important. What I'm offering today is trying to offer a starting place so we can actually have some really good conversations to that. So I look forward to more conversations. Again, I know this bill is being laid over. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to use my chair purview of asking my new co-chair, Representative Pinto, to maybe give us an overview as Chair Pinto will be starting next week. Sorry.
Very good, Chair Baker, but just to, this is being laid over, and just wanted to get that on the record. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Baker. I do want to make a comment next week, and looking forward to working with the chair. I guess maybe I'll do that, and I did want to make one closing comment about the bill. What I'll say about looking forward to working together next week and beyond, I very much am looking forward to that. And Mr. Chair, I'll say that how you've conducted the committee business, I very much appreciate it and felt it's been very fair. I've had a lot of frustrations with bill path and fiscal notes, and we'll get into all that. But regarding actually what's happened in the room, I've appreciated that. I will tell members, be prepared. So we've got, I think, more than 130 bills that are currently in the committee's possession, and so we've got a lot to consider. Be prepared that this coming Tuesday we may well come back in the evening to consider bills because we got a lot that we'll need to be looking at. Please be in touch with both chairs as things go forward. So we'll talk about that. But just to close up on this bill, there's a lot to discuss about unpaid leave, all kinds of things I have on my list. I know my colleagues do as well. Appreciate the chance to come back to it. I'll maybe just leave with one comment that feels very timely, which is that today on the floor we're going to be hearing a couple of bills that relate to the issue of birth and of new babies, right? Or this question of people getting to have choices regarding what happens with themselves and their bodies and their babies. And I just want to make sure that as we have that conversation tonight and the conversation that continues in paid leave, that we recognize that we, in fact, need to make sure that we are supporting as somebody is having that particular piece of paid leave, that if somebody is having a new baby in their lives, that they're receiving support. And that I guess I'm very concerned about rhetoric that is saying we're going to walk with somebody for a certain period of time during their pregnancy. And then after that, if they are employed at one kind of business, they get a certain number of weeks. And if they're employed at another kind of business, another kind of a week. To my mind, that particular issue is emblematic of this whole point about making sure that people who are working have dignity in their lives as well, and that every single employee is a human being, and that we're supporting that work. And so I want to make sure that we are consistent, that as my colleagues are having saying to folks that they don't get to make decisions about their lives and their own bodies as they're doing that tonight and beyond, that they're recognizing that I certainly would hope that then we are, as we're considering paid leave and other areas for employees as well, that we're standing with people all the way through, and certainly when it comes to that important issue in their lives and their families. So look forward to that discussion tonight and look forward to continued discussions in the committee, Chair and members.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. With that, 1976 is laid over, and with that, we are adjourned.